Welcome back to Maritime Morning for Thursday, November 3rd. Craig Oliver. He's written an adventure book. Well, it's a political book, but it reads like one of those boys' adventure books only for political and outdoor junkies. Craig is best known as a reporter and a political journalist for CTV. He spent a career making inquiries into Ottawa's political adventures. He's spent time in Central America and war zones and inside the Beltway in Washington, relating the issues of the day to Canadians. His new book is an intensely personal examination of his life in television and the relationships that he has developed, not only in his work, but also on some pretty fabulous canoe trips in Canada's northern wilderness. And Craig Oliver joins me on the phone this morning. Good morning, Craig.
Hey, Jordy. Good morning. How are you?
Good
morning to Halifax.
Well, I'm a little tired this morning because I picked up this book yesterday afternoon thinking that I would kind of skim through it and became totally absorbed and put it down at 1:30 last night on the last page, reading it in one sitting.
Well, it was a good cause. Thank you, Jordy. I hope you bought the book.
I didn't. Your publicist sent it to me, thank goodness.
That's fair.
But I'll tell you what, I may buy it for some gifts this Christmas because I was absolutely enthralled, and it was a wonderful, engaging, and enormously entertaining read. So
thank you so much.
Congratulations.
And I appreciate your picking up on the canoe parts of it because that is very important, and I really poured my heart into writing the canoe stuff. And a lot of people haven't been mentioning that.
Well, I thought that it was a wonderful surprise when we first jumped into the canoes together and headed off into the Yukon. I mean, these trips have been an enormously significant part of your life, and towards the end of the book, it's even characterized as a metaphor. And I'd like you to explain that a little bit and how important those trips were to you.
Well, first, the friendships were important. I suppose for those of us in the post-war era, friendships on canoe partners, canoe trips, and we were in the very high Arctic. I mean, the Arctic Circle, anything south of that was the Caribbean to us. The network of friends you make, you depend on each other for your survival. We had no guides. We did about 30 trips in 30 years. But one day when we were in the very high Arctic, only about 1,000 miles from the North Pole, in the middle of the night, I took a long walk alone way up a stony hill, and I sat there looking back on my companions all sleeping and looking at the river and the mountains, and I thought to myself that our trips were a metaphor for the whole country in the sense that we are an Arctic nation, we're a northern nation, and we depend on each other for our survival, and we can't survive without one another. We share our skills, and it just struck me that was a metaphor for Canada. We live in such a hostile environment. I think of those early people who went out to the prairie provinces at the turn of the century and lived in mud huts in 40 below weather, and how important it was for them to develop the co-op movement, the political movements that grew out of that, all kinds of them, right and left wing. So, yeah, that just struck me, and I wrote that section about that.
Well, You say those who go to the wilderness to discover themselves or God would do better to visit a therapist or a priest. I found no answers to the great perplexities of life in my years of wilderness adventuring, but rather the joy of personal achievement. And when I was talking about the metaphor, if you will, it also, I think, brings some very interesting thought to how people actually execute their careers in terms of jumping into adventure or diving into a rapid. Just your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I wrote a chapter comparing running a big rapid with going through life. First, the whole issue of meeting challenges. Meet them head on. Follow your compass, but don't follow it blindly. If you think you're maybe going into danger, get out of the rapid for a bit, back into an eddy, think about your next move, consider where you're going, talk to the people who've done the rapid before you, and take their advice about the kind of directions you might want to take. And be flexible. Don't be locked into a pathway that looks good at one moment and can change at another. But most important, be decisive. Once you make your decision, dig in hard and go for it. Don't sort of wander around indecisively in life. We can all change our lives. Any of us can, just as we can change our directions in a rapid. But to do it, we have to make decisive decisions. Mm. We have to do things to reimagine our life, just like we can reimagine the direction we're taking in a rapid. So I did that whole thing, and I hope some canoeists take some pleasure out of it. I hadn't heard a thing about that until you mentioned it now, and I've talked to lots of people about the book.
Well, Craig, I think maybe what we should do is take a copy of this or a couple and drop it off at the King's Journalism School as well for anybody who's out there looking to pursue a career in journalism, because you had some pretty interesting canoe partners as well, and obviously your book has a lot to do with the people and the relationships that you had in different parts of the country and different parts of the world, for that matter. But you did do a little canoeing with former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, and that must have been quite an extraordinary experience.
Well, it was. I knew 10 prime ministers, and we've only had 22. And I knew them at various levels, some quite well, like Diefenbaker, Mulroney, to some extent Harper. But, I did know Trudeau better than anyone. We became friends, which is probably not an entirely good thing if you're a political reporter. It's a fine line, and, I've confessed in that book that I probably went over the line in his case. And so for 9 years, I went to Washington to be deloused after getting to know Trudeau so well that that I compromised myself, I think. But I would never apologize for having been a friend of that great man. And, he was a great canoe partner. He was an extremely good canoeist. He was a private person, just as he was in his own life as a politician. He was on the canoe trips. He wasn't a laugh a minute, but he did his job. He never asked for any favors. He made the fireplaces that will last for 1,000 years. They'll still be there for Arctic travelers. He dragged canoes around, and he did his share of the work on the trip.
Well, Craig, your fondness for the high Arctic is profound, and it comes through very clearly in this book. Just before we move on to some of the political things, your thoughts on the state of the Arctic and what the Canadian government is doing in order to not only preserve our sovereignty over the Arctic, but also to address some of the issues around the environment?
Well, I don't want to give too much credit to Stephen Harper. After all, I'm a reporter. My job is to be critical of people in government. But he is really the first prime minister who has seriously not just talked about Arctic sovereignty, but done things about it. As you know, he's building, the money is now there, and you and Halifax will be, well, I think probably Vancouver will be building the icebreaker, but because of that, we're going to be building a serious Arctic icebreaker, which we badly need. We're going to be building a whole series of so-called patrol boats, good-sized boats, really, but naval vessels that will increase our sovereignty in the Arctic. Harper's been making annual visits there. He's going to be building a sort of a port for these ships. He's expanding the Canadian Army presence in the high Arctic. I mean, we have to persuade the world that the Arctic is ours because we're heavily challenged up there. The only people who respect our sovereignty in the Northwest Passage, for instance, is us. Nobody else in the world does. So this is a big challenge for us. The Arctic ice is breaking up fast. Chunks the size of Newfoundland are dropping off the ice shelves. And very soon it's going to be an international waterway. And we're going to have to decide how we're going to deal with that. So I have to commend Harper for finally, after years of people talking about how important the Arctic is to us, saying, I'm going to put some muscle, some beef, behind our argument that the sovereignty of the Arctic and protecting Arctic water is a major job of ours. And if the best we can, we're sharing that sovereignty, not the sovereignty, but we're sharing the management of Arctic resources with other countries peacefully. And that so far is going well.
Craig, you call Harper charismatic in waiting, which I thought was a great way to actually characterize who he is. And I get the sense from that you feel that he has not yet quite figured out how to touch Canadians in the kind of emotional way that a Pierre Trudeau would, or perhaps some other figures that we've had in our political past.
I think that's true. I don't think he's beloved. I think he's respected, which is very important for people in politics. I think people admire his determination, his toughness. People who like his policies like them very much. And obviously enough people like them that they finally gave him the majority government he wants. He's a very private person, just like Pierre Trudeau was. And he's not a laugh a minute, neither was Trudeau. And I wouldn't fault either of them for that. What I say in the book is that I have a hard time reconciling the sort of obsessive secrecy control of his government, the character of his government, with his personal character, which I've had lots of one-on-one times with him. And he's always respectful, polite, and considerate. So there seems to be a contradiction there between his personal characteristic and the label that people put on his government, which is sometimes not a very friendly one.
Well, there is a contradiction there, and I've had some personal experience with him as well. But I thought that the way you characterize it was very, very good. You go through, this book. If anybody wants a fast political history of this country, I think provides that in spades. You start in the 1960s in terms of your broadcast career.
Yeah, I know with Diefenbaker and Tommy Douglas.
I know you get into it's an intensely personal book at the beginning, and you talk about your upbringing. I'll leave that to readers to wade through themselves. But when you get into your career, there's some wonderful anecdotes when you were in Prince Rupert of your early days in radio. I won't get into some of the ones with the spicier language, but I want to talk about this guy by the name of Hank Hankinson, former producer with CBC International Service. And he apparently said something to you that apparently has been quite, I guess it's been a bit of a guide for you. And that is he drove us into the idea, you write, that every word is a building block of thought, a crystallized idea, as he put it. And that seems to me to be something that you have been able to use as a guide for you in your career. Would you agree with that?
Yes. And I also read Shakespeare for the same reason, but Shakespeare was doing it before the rest of us and doing it so beautifully. His ability to compress ideas, to compress complex ideas into sort of one or two words. And that was what Hankinson always impressed on us when we were writing, that we should try to pick the right word for every instance and work on getting the right word and, get a thesaurus. Because every word means something different in terms of the ideas it conveys. And I've always thought of that. But my best lesson in Prince Rupert was really, this was a real small town radio, 250 watts, and if we lost the light bulb, we're out of business. And one of the things we had to do, there were no unions in those days, and we had to clean the place once a week. So one day I was, cleaning out a toilet bowl, and the chief announcer, who was sweeping the floor, said to me, "Oliver, do you know why you're doing that?" And I said, "No, sir." In those days, your boss was sir. He said, "So that our powerful and important positions will not make us too proud." And I've never lost that. That feeling that don't start thinking you're important because you happen to be on the radio. Because in my case, if I hadn't fallen into this business, I'd probably be cleaning washrooms in the Parliament buildings.
Craig Oliver. The name of the book is Oliver's Twist, The Life and Times of an Unapologetic News Hound. We're going to take a little commercial break because we got to pay for all this entertainment and come back with more about the book, his stories in Ottawa and Washington. Craig Oliver in just a moment here on Maritime Morning. Welcome back to Maritime Morning. We're talking with Craig Oliver. As I say, it's his adventure book, The Life and Times of an unapologetic news sound. There are times in here, as I said in the opening, it felt like reading one of those books when you're a kid about the boys' adventures running around in the rapids of the Nahanni and the jungles of Nicaragua and El Salvador. That was a particularly difficult period, I can imagine, when you were posted in Washington for a time. As you said, you went for your delousing from Ottawa. Yeah. They sent you down to Washington, and of course we had the conflicts going on in Central America at the time. Did that change you in any significant way, encountering the things that you encountered there?
I had never seen war before, and that was war very close up. It was very sinister, very violent, really ugly, and it matures you. It makes you, it brings home the idea of personal freedom and the importance of, it's so corny, the importance of free elections and the idea of democracy and sharing. And what can go wrong when people can't make a deal? I think I read in the book about being out with a company in the Salvadoran army, and they were ambushed while I was with them. And I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to stand up and shoot back. I just hid in a hole. But I thought as I lay there, it seemed so profound in the time, at the town now at time. It, now it seems so June, but I lay there thinking, this is what happens when people have reached the end of their failure to agree about things that are important to them. They start killing each other. And the last person standing, I guess, wins. I remember thinking that as I lay there, hearing them all blasting back and forth at each other.
And at that point, your motivation is survival.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, it sure was. Although it was all relatively small arms. So my chances of getting hurt were, well, they were there. A guy got wounded few feet away from me, and they had to take him out in a helicopter. But, I mean, I was ducked down in a hole. There was no artillery, so I didn't have too much to worry about as long as I didn't stand up.
Your son Murray's been off reporting in the wilds of Africa and has spent time in Afghanistan. You have to, being a father, I know that you're going to be concerned about your son, but does the experience there actually give you some comfort in the fact that you've been exposed to it, or do you find that it's more worrisome?
I think so. Although the thing about covering a war in Central America in those days, and now Afghanistan for the kids who went over there, is that at least in Central America, you could make judgments about risk. You had some control over your fate. But in Afghanistan, you get in one of these damn armored vehicles and you're rolling along feeling fine, and suddenly all of you are blown up. There's just no making judgments, really, about your safety in the same way as there was in the wars I did. Also, what made ours more dangerous, of course, was we were out on our own, and we'd link up with troops here and there or guerrillas, but we had no medical protection. If we were wounded or anything like that, the slightest wound, you could bleed to death before. But there were no, and when you're traveling with the Canadian Army in Afghanistan, you have the best medical care anywhere around.
Mm.
So, you know.
Well, I guess the war has changed somewhat, and reporting on the war has changed, but reporting in general has gone through some pretty remarkable changes. And you address that to some degree in terms of the influx of new media and the broader, so I guess they kind of call
Jordy,
it. Yes.
I'm just going to tell you that my friend Lloyd Robertson has just called me on a cell phone. Do you mind if I just tell him, Lloyd, can I call you back?
Sure, you bet.
Okay, Jordy says hello, Lloyd.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I actually had Lloyd on when he retired here. What are you, setting up some date to go riding or something?
We're actually setting up a dinner date in Toronto when I'm down there.
Well, there was a great story in your book about when Lloyd and you were invited to go out to the Calgary Stampede as well as the Grand Marshals of the parade, and he took up riding, and you've been riding chums since, huh?
Well, I've been riding all my life. I have my own horse. I competed in jumping before my vision got so bad I needed a seeing eye horse. But they wanted Lloyd to be in the parade as the Grand Marshal. I was just kind of along as a sidekick. And they said, we'll put you in a limo. And I said, limo hell. Lloyd, you got to ride a horse. But he had hardly been on a horse. So then they said to him, well, if you want to be on a horse, we'll get a guy with a rope on the horse, and he'll walk in front of you pulling the horse. I said, you'll have 100,000 people laughing at you, Eastern dude who has to be pulled along on a horse. So he went and took riding lessons at a barn near Toronto and became quite adept. And so when he did the parade, at one point, his horse decided to turn around and go back to the beginning of the parade again, and he wheeled it around. He looked like John Wayne. The crowd applauded. And since then, Lloyd and I have been doing summers riding in the mountains for a week.
Just on a little more about Lloyd, because he joined you at CTV a short time after you had gone over. You both had been working at the CBC.
Yep.
And I was particularly taken with your attitude toward the CBC when you finally did decide to leave. And that, you know, you've got a bureaucracy. You have people who are there that are simply there waiting for their pensions and that kind of thing. There was, you know, I suppose to some degree I left for the same reason. Do you think that they've changed as an entity? And now that we're sitting here looking at the CBC and the funding of what it is, has it changed that much?
Yes. I mean, I was talking about 1970.
On Jarvis Street.
Street. And incredibly incompetent management. Remember, the Secretary of State at the time, Judy LaMarche, had shortly before that talked about rotten management. It was a particularly bad time in CBC history. I think that it's a pretty competently run organization these days. You know, we can argue that there are unions that maybe aren't flexible enough. We can argue that they may be inefficient and all that, but in terms of anybody suggesting getting rid of the Corp, that is a non-starter as far as I'm concerned. It's just such an important cultural institution. There are all kinds of things wrong with them all, the cultural institutions, I suppose. You could have a symphony orchestra you didn't like very much, but the answer is not to get rid of them.
Craig, it's been a delight having you on the program, and you know, talk show barker that I am.
Good one, Jordy. You're a good one.
I hope that this gets under a lot of Christmas trees this year, because it really is. It's a delightful read, and I know for people that are in the business as we are, but those who are even interested in politics tangentially or are interested in Canada's more recent history, it's a delightful and very comfortable and entertaining read. So thanks again.
Thank you, Jordy. I appreciate it very much. You're a great guy to give me the chance to talk about the book.
You bet. Oliver's Twist. It's the life and times of an unapologetic news hound, Craig Oliver. And I mean that. I sat down yesterday at 4 o'clock, Todd, and opened it up. I thought, okay, well, I'll have to skim this, you know. And I started reading it on page one, and I didn't put it down until I got to, what was it, page 330 or whatever it was at the end, and the whole thing was very enjoyable.
How long did it take you?
I think I put it down at midnight, so.
Yeah, that's quite a read, 300 and some odd pages. That's a serious read.
Well, I had to have a little beverage there in the middle just to, you know, but it was good.
Good. Yeah, no, excellent. And you're talking about legends of legends there when it comes to this business, no doubt about it.
What have you got on there, future legend Todd Vino?
Oh, sure. Future. Well, what about current legend? Silence ensues.
What have you got on this afternoon?
Lots to talk about. Maclean's Magazine always does a great job. Kathy Gulley, associate editor at Maclean's, wrote a very interesting story about Sidney Crosby's rebuilding process. And it's interesting because a chiropractor developed a system for treating concussions, which was totally contradictory to a lot of science and what people were doing. And it really made all the difference. So a great insight, great story. We'll talk with Kathy Gulley about that. This Remembrance Day pub crawl, we heard a lot about that. We'll speak with one of the organizers, Edward Jenkins, because it's going to continue. That created and caused quite a stir nationally. As well, we'll talk about infrastructure and the necessity of it with John Gamble, president of the consulting, or rather of the National Infrastructure Strategy. That and the wheat board as well. We hear a lot about the wheat board, and I know that it's a long way to Western Canada, but it's still of interest here as well. We'll have a conversation with Alan Oberg, chair of the Canadian Wheat Board. That and lots more coming right up, Jordy.
Future legend Todd Vino coming up here on News 95.7 in Halifax and in St. John and in Moncton. I'm back tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Jordy Morgan. This is Maritime Morning.